It's classic, man. It's evergreen.
Well, let's just dive into it, man. Welcome to the Hackaday Podcast. My name is Mike Stish. I'm editor-in-chief of Hackaday.
Hi, I'm Elliot Williams. I'm managing editor of Hackaday.
This is episode 88. Today, we're talking about a flywheel trebuchet, thieving magpies, hero engines, and hypermiling. 1 million comments.
1 million comments.
1 million. Hackaday has had 1 million comments, Elliot, in the last 16 years.
Or at least we will have by the time this podcast is recorded.
Yeah, we are hundreds away. You can nearly count them on both hands if you had hundreds of fingers on your hands. So I'm doing the math right now. It is greater than 26 comments per article on average. That's okay. Wild. So what does a million matter? I don't know. There's a lot of zeros in that number, so people celebrate that kind of stuff. But if you have listened to the podcast at all in the last 2 years, you know that we're constantly talking about the cool stuff that we see in that those comments. And that's because people that have these like niche skills who you never run into real life end up turning up in the comments when we write the articles. I don't know of another place that it happens like that, and I just love it.
The coolest thing that happened last week in the comments, to me anyway, was I wrote this article on dynamic soaring, and the guy who basically invented dynamic soaring for gliders showed up in the comments section. He is a legend. He's like the best glider pilot around. And he's like, hi, here I am in the comments.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that I really keep a Rolodex of the awesome moments in my mind. But one of them that really sticks out was that years ago, we were covering some NASA International Space Station stuff. And Ed Van Cise, the flight director of the ISS, like got into the comments and was talking about it. And then I think we ended up getting in contact with him. He wrote a couple articles for us too, which was super cool. So we see people from the telecommunications industry talking about, you know, the changes in networks over the years. And I just was working on editing an article from Dan that's going to come out on Monday about the local loop of telephone service. And he closes it by saying, like, were you someone that worked on this? Share your experience in the comments. And people do that. They do it all the time.
Tons of meaty little nuggets out of that one.
Yeah. So thank you, everyone who has made awesome comments through the years. For a little, I said levity in the article. I threw in Roger's bingo card for comment bingo. Do you remember that one, Elliot?
Yeah, absolutely.
So Roger, we kind of vent sometimes as Hackaday writers on the writer's email group about nitpickers and especially repeat nitpickers. And so Roger put together a bingo card of the very, very common sayings that people put in there that we kind of makes us roll our eyes. You'll want to take a look at that one. It's, you know, the things like, I could have done that with a 555. Elliot, I think your favorite
that one
is...
I love the 555 one. I think that's awesome. But go ahead.
Well, I've also seen people go the other way when you have a 555 project and someone says, I could have done that with an 8-bit microcontroller a lot faster and with less components.
Would have been so much cleaner if you just did it with a Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, I think your pet peeve on the comments is when someone says, why did you do this? You could have just bought it for a lot less money.
Oh, yeah. And my actual, another favorite that wasn't on the bingo list is the comments that all start with technically. Because everyone's
technically.
Like, actually, or technically, this. And you know that they're going to be saying something that's irrelevant, which is what they mean by technically.
So we're looking forward to another million comments. Put on your positive, constructive criticism hat and let us know what you think in the comments of this show.
All right, what else is in the news?
Well, I just wanted to mention to everyone, if they missed it, right at the end of September, Bill Hurd published a video and a little short write-up. He was able to go into the Moss Technology headquarters, which has been shut down and sitting vacant for decades. But it's where the Commodore 64 was born, the Commodore 128 that he was the principal hardware engineer on. It's where the 6502 chip was fabbed, and kind of a iconic place in hardware history that is, it's nothing. I mean, it's a shell now. And so it was interesting in the article to hear what Bill remembers from working there and his fond memories. He goes in and talks about the way the offices were at the beginning. For me, it gets really cool when he goes down into the basement and there are just pallets of junk down there. And so you see these iconic old machines with smashed screens on them, and there's some, you know, tractor printers down there and tape backups, magnetic tape backups. He mentions he found wafers, but we only see the equipment for building the wafers. I didn't actually see any of the wafers themselves in that video. It's just a nice little walk through an abandoned piece of computer history.
All right, shall we get down to hacks?
We should do it.
Okay, my first hack this week is reel in the years with a cassette player synth. This is actually a fairly simple hack, but it's just a beautiful result. Scholes took a cassette player. You remember what tape players are, right? This was one of the ones that has a variable speed dial on it. And this variable speed dial turns out to be nothing more than a potentiometer. And you can accordingly control the speed of its playback by putting a voltage on that middle pin on the pot. The hack here then is to record a single tone, like a really long running single tone there. Play the tape back then at different speeds and you can get different pitches out of it. Scholes takes this and tries to turn it into a kind of musical instrument by hooking up the DAC to an Arduino and then controlling the Arduino, strangely enough, by a script over serial on his computer. And then he's got another piece of code that takes MIDI in to his computer, turns it into these funny serial commands that are literally the word voltage and then like 1.1. And then the DAC on the Arduino spits out 1.1 volts to the cassette player, which then plays at the right speed. It's this kind of, it's a little bit Rube Goldberg-y, but it was the simplest possible way to solve each of these discrete problems. And I kind of appreciate that.
So I have a question on this, because you're talking about the potentiometer that you can turn on this. You just need to supply an analog voltage, which is what the trim pot would have been doing in the first place. Some people would use like a digital potentiometer instead. Is there a difference between those?
There is. Digital potentiometers are kind of DACs with crappy resolution. They basically all have, the ones I've seen are like 256 step, which is pushing it if you're trying to get, you know, precise musical pitches out of things. On the other hand, part of the charm of making your music this way is that it's an old cassette player and it kind of, you know, it warbles a little bit and its pitch is all over the place anyway. So maybe it would have been fine, but with only 256 possible values, it's actually really hard to line them up so that they play, you know, the Western kind of equal temperament scale.
In this case, they are actually using a DAC chip. This is the MCP4725.
I was a little bit surprised that when I first saw this, I was like, oh, this is really clever. And I thought that the Arduino would be doing the MIDI in. Instead, there's a computer in the loop. If you're listening out there, Scholes, you should look into the Arduino MIDI in code. It's actually really simple to use, and you could make this a standalone MIDI device with like 15 more lines of code. Take the computer entirely out of the loop.
Oh, yeah, and you could make it smaller to get rid of the Uno that's on here, the Arduino Uno, and use one of the really small boards that might even fit inside the case of that cassette player.
Oh, now you're just like trying to make it all fancy.
Well, you want to be able to take it to your jam sessions, right?
Yeah, totally. This reminded me of some old projects by Yeeks Yeeskis, who used to play with cassette tape machines all the time. And one of my favorites of his did exactly the same trick, except it had 8 keys on it, and each of these 8 keys are hooked up to a potentiometer. So he's got like a, or maybe it's 12 keys, I don't know. Anyway, he's got a bunch of little push buttons, and each one has a knob with which you can adjust its pitch and playback. So you kind of get like a custom keyboard. It's like entirely low tech in that it doesn't have an Arduino, it doesn't have a DAC, doesn't have anything. It's just got buttons and some pots, but it solves the problem in a really nice and kind of musically playable way. And of course, in the comments, someone had to say, you know, this is really just a poor man's Mellotron. And of course it is. If you haven't seen a Mellotron, it's an older, I guess they come from the 60s. It was another tape playback piano thing. It does, for instance, if you think of that flute sound at the beginning of Strawberry Fields Forever, and it's that kind of warbly, tweedoo, 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 that's a Mellotron.
It's kind of crazy to think about the difference in modern media versus older media for hacking. For instance, where would we be without record scratching, right? Such a cool effect, right, on that media. And then you have Mellotron and hacks like this that let you speed up and slow down the tape. And even just like cutting the tape up and and splicing it back
old
together
tape
different
collage
orders.
Stuff
yeah, like very cool stuff like that. I mean, we've seen projects where they took miles and miles of tape and kind of like wallpapered it onto a wall, and then you put the reed heads on the fingers of gloves and you drag your finger down the tape on the wall. And then I look at, you know, CDs and I'm like, well, what, you can't do any of that cool stuff with CDs.
No, you can't. But what you can do with CDs is then you can get the music digitally, and then, you know, the world is your oyster. Then you can chop it and granule it and, you know, do all sorts of crazy stuff with it.
Yeah, there is. I mean, it opens up a new possibility there, but it closes a door. I guess the one thing I was thinking with CDs is you end up building CNC machines out of the reed head, you know, screw hardware that's in them.
Now, I don't think there's anything good about CDs except they store a lot of digital data. I think aesthetically, they're just horrible. Right? Like a record's really great and tapes are really great. And a CD, meh. It's shiny.
It's shiny, yeah. Ooh, shiny. So I have component trays that are hanging on the wall right above where all my soldering stuff is. You're familiar with the kind, they have a metal frame that these little flimsy plastic boxes slide into. And the boxes, you know, they're long, they're deep, but they're not very wide, not very tall, you know, maybe an inch and a half wide and an inch tall. And the plastic just kind of is bendy and wavy. And, you know, they work fine. They kind of tend to fall out if you're not careful. And it's hard to get labels to stick to them. And I got to say, Zach Friedman has solved this with style. This is an article that Tom wrote about the project called The Amazing Technicolor Parts Organizer. And it's a set of contoured brackets that snap onto the front of each drawer. And they give you a little bit easier time pulling out the drawer. You can fit your finger in underneath it. They also provide a little place for a snap-in laser-etched label that makes the appearance of having white lettering on a black background, so it's really high contrast. But the thing that'll catch your eye right away is Zach used rainbow filament in the 3D printer to print these, and he printed them out all in sequential order. So this wall full of these component drawers is a rainbow going across it. It's really awesome.
At first, I thought they were all 3D printed drawers, but then, of course, that doesn't make any sense because the color would fade like into the drawer where you can't see it anyway, and you don't want that. This way is much better and I guess uses a heck of a lot less plastic.
I don't know if this is for me. I mean, it would make the workbench look really great, but I have so much piles of crap everywhere in my workshop that no set of adding color to the organized part is going to make it look better until I clean that up. But I've seen people that use like inventory systems that put NeoPixel, like a WS2812, behind the drawers. And then when you type into your computer, I need X part, it'll like light the drawer up so you know where to put it, which would be interesting with these. I think that since this is passive, like it's just sitting there all the time, it looks really great. The ability to label them and not have the labels fall off is good. I find this material for labeling to be interesting. In his write-up, Zach said that it's just some leftover plastic stock, but when it gets engraved by the laser, it leaves very white letters. It almost looks like those materials that are made for this. And maybe it is. I don't know where the, you know, extra plastic stock came from.
Yeah, I bet it's just painted black and he just like ate away the black paint on the front, leaving the clear plastic beneath.
Well, Zach is wearing a Hackaday Prize t-shirt in the video, and I know we met him at the badge hacking of SuperCon last year. So, Zach, if you're listening to this, leave a comment here or on your article. Let us know where that plastic came from.
All right, my next hack is another YouTube video from Tom Stanton. He's returning to one of my favorite features that he's done, Flywheel Trebuchet Spins Right Round. About 2 years ago, when I first discovered Tom Stanton's YouTube channel, he had a trebuchet project and he got it throwing tennis balls at about 124 miles an hour. And I really loved it because he kind of did a deep dive into the trebuchet physics. And he actually used a really interesting video-based physics data tracker and extractor called physlets.org tracker. I'll throw the links for that in here. You really need to look at that if you haven't. And he got his old wooden trebuchet to throw tennis balls at 124 miles an hour, which is not too shabby. But turns out the competitive tennis players can serve at about 150 miles an hour. And he really wanted to beat that. Now, if you don't know what a trebuchet is, it's an old, I guess they're siege weapons. On one end, there's a sling and it's got a pivot in the middle and it's got a heavy weight on the other end. So you hold the heavy weight up, you put the stuff you want to throw in the sling, you drop the heavy weight, the sling gets slung and whatever gets thrown out. That's a classic trebuchet. In this case, he's making a flywheel trebuchet. So instead of the potential energy in a really heavy weight, he spins the whole thing up as fast as he can. And then he presses in a little clutch that lets the sling fly free and it goes whoosh, and it throws the tennis ball. It's an absolutely beautiful machine here. He looks like he had a super fun time kind of doing the CAD design and cutting it out of aluminum. It's just, this is what you would do if you had a pretty good aluminum CNC mill in your basement, I think. And I think he's really just, some of it he's just doing because he's got it.
I'm kind of put off on this one because he talks about all these mechanisms as if they're so obvious and so easy. And I gotta think there was some head scratching, like there's a special mechanism to hold the ball with the sling outstretched, and then there's a special mechanism to trigger it at just the right moment, and that mechanism is a little bit adjustable so that you know, if it's throwing the ball with too high of a trajectory or too low of a trajectory, that can all be adjusted. It's a really good design element that he just kind of mentions in passing.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on in this one. I think partly because he did like everything possible about trebuchets in the last, I guess it was even a series of three videos. So he's covered a lot of the details of this before, but you're right. And one of my favorite things about this one is that a lot of the different parts are adjustable here. And that includes the thing that releases the ball so that it starts swinging, and then the part that lets go of the other half of the sling so that the ball actually flies free. And these details, like where in the trajectory the ball gets let go of and whether it's at its maximum outstretched length at that time, are super critical for kind of maximizing the speed you can get out of the thing. He, in the end, gets his tennis ball up to 180 miles an hour. He's really cranking the heck out of this thing. It's lovely to see. It looks a little bit dangerous.
Yeah.
Like at one point he pulls the trigger and the thing falls over on him and he's like, oh yeah, I should really screw that into the ground.
Yeah, I was wincing a little bit when you could see it spinning so fast and it's like 24 inches from his head. And I'm like,
yeah.
Do not catastrophically fail, please.
He does screw it into the ground, but you could still see the thing wobbling back and forth. And I share your concern. His last trick with this is he notices that once it lets go of the tennis ball, once he's gotten it all calibrated for maximum tennis ball speed, the trebuchet arm is still spinning pretty quickly. And that's a sign that there's still some energy left in the machine that wasn't conveyed to the ball. At this point, the only thing he can do to get more energy into the projectile, short of redesigning the whole machine, is to just use a heavier and heavier projectile. And he does this great experiment where he uses progressively heavier projectiles until the arm is basically just standing still after it lets go. And that's the sign that it's like completely transferred all of its energy into the flinging ball. I love the way he benchmarks these things, and he's like looking at the video frames and going, well, let's see, it travels this far in this time, so I know it's going this fast.
He's got the super high frame rate camera set up in perfect profile to the apparatus. And because he knows the exact length of the arm on the trebuchet, he can compare frames of how far the ball has traveled and then measure on the still images how far that is based on the trebuchet arm. And that's how he calculates it. I also love it that he's just sitting there with his graphing calculator, you know, doing the majority of these calculations. And I'm like, he didn't even need to write, you know, a script to plug anything in. He's just doing it the old engineer way. Although that might have been a slide rule, Elliot.
Uh-huh.
So I wonder with the, you know, we're both talking about it being a little rickety when he's cranking. I mean, that's from the force he's putting into it to like lift this crank up and push it over the top and get it back down. I wonder if the thing's actually really stable because the flywheel has a gyroscopic effect.
I think the flywheel isn't well enough balanced, and that's why you see it wanting to lift up off the ground as he's spinning it. I think he didn't quite balance the flywheel, and so when you get it spinning really fast, it's got a lot of energy, and the thing's basically a bucking bronco at that point.
You just need to drop down some concrete footings and threaded rod in there.
Yeah, but that's not the point of this build anyway. The point of this is to see if you can make the first ever flywheel trebuchet I've ever seen.
When you're not mounting siege to your neighbors, you can help them clean up the neighborhood by training magpies to pick up beer bottle caps.
That's what I always do.
This is not a metaphor. This is actually what is happening. Hans Forsberg has been playing around hacking the minds of birds, or bird brains as he likes to call them, to see if he can train these magpies, which are actually really, really smart birds, to do things. And it's just fascinating for me to watch because I've never considered trying to command nature in such a way. The finished project that's being featured here has a couple of 3D printed parts. There's basically a small desktop. Think of like the desk that you had in grade school. And in the middle of it, there's a little red 3D printed piece that has a hole in it that you can drop a bottle cap into. And when the system senses that bottle cap being dropped, right next to it, there's a little pipe that comes down from a hopper and a peanut falls down. So the bird is getting reinforced with the peanut. I thought the build itself was very interesting. But since then, Hans has actually gone a lot more in depth on his YouTube channel about how he got to this point. There was a little bit of that before, but for me, it's the actual bird hacking. And the process that he used actually started with just a button that has some food inside of it. So the bird is going to want to try and get the food out of that button, and in the process pushes the button and gets rewarded with a peanut right next to it. And then there's a bunch of progressing steps since May. He started this at the beginning of the summer that's gotten us to where we are now.
Yeah, there's a bunch of birds that are smarter than you give them credit for. And magpies are one of them. Crows are another. There's a guy in our neighborhood, actually, who feeds the crows in the morning. And he goes walking around with cat food and pitches it out. And they, at about 8 o'clock, when he's out walking, are perched on all the building tops all around the building. And they totally recognize him and they come flying out at him. So I'm not at all surprised that you can train magpies to pick up bottle caps.
Some of the more interesting parts of this one, he tried to see how distance plays into this. He wanted to see if he could get two magpies to tag team the system. And so he took that button and moved it further and further away to see if one would push the button while the other ate the food or something along these lines. But he says it seems that their brains are wired very much for if you do something right here, the effect will happen right here. And so once you get, you know, up to a meter away or something, they start to have diminishing returns on what they'll actually do.
And my guess is if you press the button here and another bird came and ate your peanut, that's not a reward for you for pressing the button.
But I mean, I wouldn't put it past them to be smart enough that they would take turns.
I don't know if birds are that social.
Well, if you think about building a nest, right? You would have two birds working in unison to gather materials to build a nest.
Do they? I don't know. Is it not one bird that builds the nest? I'm not a bird expert.
I've just spent several years trying to get robins to not build a nest on the light right outside of our back door. And so my naive observations have me thinking that it was both birds in that happy bird family that were building the nest.
Bastards. Anything else to say about this?
No, I like bastards as a closing statement. It's a good one.
All right, my next hack is a demonstration of the boundless possibilities of software. Sarah Adkins' Go Board step sequencer, Let's Go Make Some Music, is really cool. I don't know if you know the game Go. It's a 13 by 13 board, and you put a bunch of white and black stones down and you try to encircle your opponent's stones and take them off the board. Here, it's both a Go game and a music sequencer. So every time you put down a white stone, there's a camera and a computer running OpenCV, and it recognizes the white stone. And depending on where you put it in the board, across kind of the X-axis of the board, it puts it on a different beat of a cycle, and then across the y-axis, it plays a different type of musical instrument depending on where you put the stone. The black stones ends up doing different percussion instruments, and the white player ends up doing either a drone or a melody depending on where they put it. So she has a marvelous video demo of this where she and someone else are actually playing a game of Go together, but at the same time, it's kind of putting together this weird algorithmic musical experiment over the top of it. And I don't know, I just thought it was really crazy cool. A while back, we've actually seen a bunch of different sequencer type things where they'll have a hole in a box and it'll have a light dependent resistor underneath it. And so you'll have a strip of 16 of these holes and you'll put like marbles over the top or Legos or something like that to play the different notes in time. But all of these are really hard because they involve, you know, a huge array of light dependent resistors or a bunch of arcade buttons or, you know, some kind of physical hardware. What I think is really cool about this one is the only real physical hardware here besides the Go board itself is a webcam. And it's just a webcam sitting there pointed down at it. And all the rest of it is done in software, from the recognition to the equivalent of the button pressing to the generation of the different musical notes and pitches and melodies and whatever else. All of it taken care of with little tippy-tippy, a bunch of words into a computer.
You could totally roll this into a Raspberry Pi setup with some portable speakers and a battery and bring this to a party or like, you know, the Friday night party for SuperCon and set it on a table somewhere, and people would just be addicted to it all night trying to do different sequencing on the Go board. I think, you know, a lot of times you look at how stepping software or looping software works and it seems very complicated, but the approachability of this board and these white pebbles and black pebbles is so simple that people are just like, I'm definitely going to try that, where they, you know, they would shy away from the computer interface otherwise.
Yeah, and another one that reminds me of is this kind of augmented reality sandbox idea. I don't know, have you ever played with one of these before?
No, I've just seen videos.
So someone keeps bringing at least one. Actually, I think one year there were two to the different Chaos Communication Congresses. And I've gotten to play with these a bunch, but mostly they're just too many kids around the sandbox to get in at all. The idea is you put a Kinect over the top of a sandbox, and then that gives you a height map. And so if you make a mountain, then a projector projects a picture of a mountain onto it. And if you kind of carve out a valley, it'll put water there. The really cool thing, though, is that it's happening all the time live. And so you can kind of, as people are like digging out trenches, the water fills in exactly behind them. And it's just an absolute joy to play with. And again, what is it? It's a projector, it's a Kinect, and then it's a bunch of code over a sandbox. Like, there's nothing at all difficult to make in that setup because it's all taken care of using a little bit of computer vision, 3D sensing with the Kinect in this case. I just like that idea of making super quick and easy, you know, almost zero expense, but incredibly immersive kind of virtual things that everyone can share into, because instead of being like a little hologram that's projected into your VR glasses, it's actually kind of a cool virtual reality layer played over real objects that everyone can interact with at the same time.
So we've featured a lot of Stirling engines on Hackaday over the years, but I don't remember us featuring a Hero engine before. And this is a very cool steam-powered device. It was kind of credited as the first engine design ever built. It's from the first century AD, also known as the Eliopile. So this week we're treated to a very realistic recreation of this by the Make It Extreme channel. And it is, let's see how to describe this. It is a sphere that you channel steam into, and the sphere can freely rotate on an axis. And perpendicular to that axis, there are these outputs that let steam shoot out, and it ends up spinning the sphere up to a very high speed. Now, the original design for this started with what looks like a metal wash basin that you could wash your face in. And it puts a lid over the top of it. And that's like the boiler where you put the water and you build a fire underneath it. And then it has two pipes going up that end up being the supports for the axis of the sphere, which is going to be parallel to the ground. And they allow the seam to get into the sphere, and they also allow the sphere to rotate. And then there's these two little jet engines on opposite sides that are spurting out. It's a real treat to watch this machined up and welded out of raw materials. Very beautifully done. And it's incredible how fast it gets rotating immediately after they start the fire under it.
Yeah, I love watching them build this. Those two like bowls that they make the sphere out of are actually from IKEA, from IKEA to you Americans. And those are like a classic. I've seen Tesla coils where they use these as the ball on top. And here they're using it to make like an ancient Greek engine. I don't know. Those are like, everybody should have at least two or three of those IKEA bowls and a welding machine in their basement, I think. Yeah. I can't imagine building this thing, though, because like you say, it works by jetting out hot steam at two different angles that kind of push this thing, turn it around as it's going. I can't imagine wanting to be in the same room as this thing as it's sitting out there just spitting out hot steam everywhere. You wonder why nobody ever made a car like this.
I remember from years ago first seeing this on a YouTube video, and I went and dug that one out by Mr. Bell Science. It's really a lovely one. He has a glass version of it. This is like a video of the professor in physics class teaching students. And so it's a really good way if you just want to, you know, get cut straight to all of the concepts that are going into this. But the apparatus he's using is blown glass. So it has a glass sphere and it has...
Sweet.
Glass outlets coming out that act both as the axis and as the jet. So they come out like straight along the axis, and then they take an opposite right angle to jet on opposite ends. And then he just uses a little Bunsen burner to boil the water that's inside.
All right, today I've got three quick hacks, starting off with Suryan Singh's Weigh Your Car with Paper. This is a really cute thought experiment. He wants to race his old Saab 96, and he needs to know how much it weighs, but the accurate racing scales around him are kind of expensive. Then he's scratching his head, and he thinks, you know the air pressure in the tires. If you can measure the contact patch on the floor, you could back out the weight of the car. And he does this. The paper trick is that lets him figure out exactly where the tires are hitting the floor by jamming pieces of paper in until they catch on the rubber. He ends up with an estimate of 2,300 pounds, and the car actually weighs 2,010 when he takes it to legit scales to get verified. So... it's ballpark right, but if you consider that car tires probably have hard sidewalls and it's a little bit difficult to account for how much of the tread is actually on the floor and how much is kind of floating, you know, that's not so bad. Anyway, an awesome little thought experiment. I'm glad he did it, and I'm glad he wrote it up. Next up, Aaron Christoffel's clock is not readable by humans. If you have one of those 64 by 64 LED panels, what are you going to do with it? Well, it's perfect for making QR codes. But like, you don't want just a single QR code sitting on your wall. So Aaron's solution is to make it a clock. A clock that shows a QR code every second that you can't read without getting your cell phone to point it at it. But of course, your cell phone has a clock on it. Anyway, this is a marvelous hack. You need one. Last up, Alexander Miller, receipt printers end it all in moving art piece. Each one of these units, and there are three of them, is a little Raspberry Pi with a thermal printer. And they're printing out a cellular automata, one of those nice linear ones. It's rule 11 something or something like that. The free end of the thermal paper is hung to the ceiling, and they kind of slowly spider their way down into a bucket of water where they all die. It's fantastic. It's technology destroying itself. It's cellular automata. It's kind of looks good, actually. What more do you want out of an art piece? I just hope that when he's done with this, he can take at least the Raspberry Pis out, dry them off, and use them again for another project. I think that may be it for the thermal printers.
First up on my list of quick hacks is one from Sean Hodgins. Sean has been using heat-set threaded inserts on its 3D parts so that you can use fasteners over and over again on them for quite a long time, but is frustrated with getting these into the plastic because the iron that he's been using, which has a special tip for the purpose, gets way too hot. It's one of those fire sticks, you just plug it in, you don't have any other control over it, which seems just silly when he has a nice Hakko soldering iron that has configurable temperature on it sitting on his bench, but he doesn't have the tip for it. However, he just picked up a lathe, and so out of some brass stock, he turns down the adapter that you need to put these in. It's a great story, ending up in a really easy to make and easy to use tool. So check that one out. I'm really excited to see a custom firmware project for this LA-104 logic analyzer. This is a very inexpensive tool that you can pick up from the Far East sources of your choosing. It is a full color screen on a nice glossy black case, and inside of it, it has an STM32 microcontroller that gives it the power to do 4-channel logic analysis along with another 4 channels of just general purpose I/O. Well, Gabriel Valky decided to take on this device and give it even more ability to do things, and it's way too many to list. It's really cool to watch him add a little CC1101 radio to the outside of it and do a bunch of signal analysis stuff. The sky's the limit here, but it's really cool to see that when you have the same chip as those Blue Pill, it really opens up the possibilities of hacking on the firmware yourself. And finally, Al Williams picked up on this article where Elaine figured out how to program the AVR0 line of chips, which uses a different programming technique than the chips that you may be used to from the AVR line. This actually uses the Universal Programming and Debug Interface, which is a one-wire protocol. But the cool thing is you can get it programmed using just a USB to serial cable, and this hack will show you how. It's time for our Can't Miss Articles of the Week. This is the long-form content written by excellent Hackaday writers. Elliot, after you.
Lewin Day has been doing a lot of car hacks lately in his series How to Get Into Cars. He's been focusing on racing and getting your cars faster and more sticking to the ground. He changes tack this week. He's into hypermiling mods, and I think that's awesome. Saving fuel is something we all should be doing, save the environment, blah, blah, blah. But it's also a chance to put yourself into the shoes of the automotive engineer and say, how can I make this car better? Where can I tweak it here or there? He starts off by saying, of course, the first thing you have to do is be able to measure your fuel economy. If you want to know, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the wrong thing? You need a benchmark. You need a baseline. So what you need to be able to do is measure your fuel economy accurately and possibly pretty quickly. He mentions there's a bunch of OBD2 port tools that you can use to do this, and they kind of give you a report of your instantaneous fuel economy because cars with fuel injectors know exactly how much they're squirting in at any given moment. So it's actually pretty easy to figure out.
Yeah, it's interesting that the automakers aren't building more of this into the interfaces. Like, you would think someone would have, I suppose Tesla has it, you'd think someone would have an app interface where you can go and like look at, you know, any given dates and how much fuel was used and how many miles were driven. Because the cars, any modern car is going to be capable of measuring that at this point. Like you said, the fuel injectors know, but also the odometer is right there, and it's all on the CAN bus, so it's available. It's really just a software problem. And that's where Lewin actually mentions that you can buy aftermarket devices that just plug in and do this.
Yeah, our car actually has a display that says how many, we're in Europe, so it's how many kilometers per liter it's getting.
Right.
So we can see this kind of instantaneously all the time, but what you said, it doesn't log it, and that's what's kind of missing. And I was thinking, if I were building one of these, I would have it log the GPS data as well. So you can tell if you're like going up over the mountains, of course you're going to get less good fuel mileage there. You probably don't want to count that against you. Versus when you're like just tooling around in the flats, that's probably, you know, the best benchmark for figuring out what your mileage is.
So if you're into hypermiling, you need like a Google Maps where you can tell it where you want to go, and it'll show you the most fuel efficient route rather than the fastest route.
Oh, that would be fun. I was just thinking you could just log all this data and take it home and analyze it later. So once you've got the way to measure your fuel consumption, now you have to do something about it. And the thing that Lewin suggests is working on your car's aerodynamics. This is pretty interesting. You know, there's lots of funny things you can do with spoilers and stuff like that to increase your grip on the ground, but all of that makes drag. Here you want to do kind of the opposite. You want to make the car as smooth on the outside as you can, which can be things like taping up large gaps on the outside of the car or, you know, reducing your rear view mirrors. Like, I could imagine putting cool fairings on your rear view mirrors that would probably help a lot because they really just kind of stick out there dumbly in the breeze. It turns out there's things you can do with the wheel wells. But then there's this over-the-top picture of a Honda Civic with, like, this super long tail that, like...
And, of course, it's a Civic, because what else would it be?
But you know that has to be a lot more aerodynamic. I wouldn't want to ever find a parking spot with that thing.
Yeah. It can't be any longer than one of those big, like, Ford F-150s, right? I mean, they're already
right.
Small hatchbacks to start with. But, yeah, this thing has a swooped back tail that comes to a point, and the tail adds... I would say easily a third of the length of the vehicle.
And then, of course, there's other things you could do, like just reduce the weight in the car. And he suggests such practical things as throwing out the back seat, which probably saves you 100 pounds, which might save you 1% off your energy bill. I'm not sure what you can do about weight. And he does mention lower rolling resistance tires, and that actually probably is a really serious gain. At least here we have to have snow and mud tires in the winter, and man, you can hear those things, so you know they are not energy efficient. I should actually look at how our gas mileage drops off when we switch over in the winter to the snow and mud tires. I'm sure that's a killer.
So when you say you have to have those in the winter, is that a necessity or a regulatory requirement?
It's a regulatory requirement.
Really? So does pretty much everyone switch out tires twice a year in Germany?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so everyone has two sets of tires.
Huh. What do you do with the other set?
You store them in your basement, or the car tire changing places will let you store them there for like $30.
So you don't have like a 14-year-old who goes around the neighborhood in the spring and says, hey, I'll change your tires for $20.
I mean, if you want to do it yourself, of course you can. You just put them in your basement. That's what we do. Anyway, before we come to the end of this, the thing I liked most about Lewin's article is where he said you will not get any mileage bonus, and that is in tweaking the engine. Because unless your car is some sort of super sports car that's tweaked for heavy power instead of mileage, it's probably the case that the car manufacturers have worked on making your engine as gas efficient as they possibly can. And the chances of you being able to beat a team of incredibly well-funded automotive engineers is probably pretty slim. So looks like choice of tires, reduce the weight, some small things like fairings and sealing up gaps on the outside of the car, and that's about what you've got to play with. But if anyone out there has got some crazy hypermiling ideas, I'd love to hear them.
All right, we got to say happy birthday to the sun, Elliot.
Happy birthday. Happy 14 millionth birthday.
Or the 25th solar cycle. So Dan has announced, or he has reported on the announcement, that the sun has entered its 25th solar cycle. It turns out that, like the Earth revolves around the sun itself has a cycle that lasts 11 years. Actually, depending on how you define it, it might last 22 years, whether you're talking about the period or not. But interestingly, this was observed a long, long time ago. The first one credited with the discovery was Samuel Heinrich Schwab, a German scientist who, after 17 years of observing sunspots, came up with the theory in 1843 that the sun has an 11-year cycle. This is probably the most interesting part to me right here is Rudolf Wolf, a Swiss scientist, carried Samuel Schwab's observations ahead by looking back on past observations going all the way back to 1755. So almost another 100 years, another, you know, 88 years of solar cycle plotting based on records from other observers, which really drives home the importance of keeping accurate data and notes so that other scientists can benefit from it. But I get off topic here, Elliot. What is a solar cycle? You want to take this one?
Certainly. No.
The sun's poles actually flip every 11 years. So what was once the magnetic north becomes the magnetic south. And the 11-year process of going through this can actually be tracked, because as the magnetic flux changes, as the poles are migrating, solar spots, the dark spots that can be observed on the sun, start to move to different parts. They start to group together differently, and they move to different latitudes on the sun itself. And this is an indication of what's going on with those poles as they flip throughout the cycle.
And so at different points in the sun's cycle, it's got more sunspots or not. And that's how the old astronomers used to keep track of it. Nowadays, it's correlated with the coronal mass ejections, the stuff the sun is spitting out on us that end up as plasma when they come here and make, for instance, the northern lights, but also charge up the ionosphere. The presence of sunspots on the sun is weird if you look at it in a telescope, but it also has something to do with our life here on Earth. And I think in particular, every ham radio operator knows that when the ionosphere is particularly charged up, when we get a lot of particles from the sun, it makes it easier to bounce signals off of it and get like long distance communications. So what does that mean? We're now at a minimum in the solar cycle, which means that what? Minimum number of sunspots means we should get crappy long distance radio?
And Dan made mention of like airlines and boats as well use this technology for their wireless. Despite the ham audience loving it when the ionosphere gets charged up, this is actually a good thing that we are at the solar low, because when it goes to the maxima, you have the most coronal mass ejections, and those can actually be very bad. Dan links to an article that he had previously written on the 1859 Carrington event that a very large amount of energy was ejected from the sun and ended up inducing currents in the telegraph cables and frying all of that communications equipment. And that may seem like a long time ago, 1859, but the laws of physics are the same now as they were back then. And so we have millions of miles of copper lines connecting together all kinds of things throughout the world. And if we were to have a very large solar event induce currents in those, it could just knock a ton of equipment out.
It'll fry your modem.
It looks like the you know, it's hard. These are unpredictable things, right? You can look at past measurements and try to predict the future. And so they're predicting that this is not going to be a particularly vigorous solar cycle, but it is an interesting thing. And I guess it is comforting to know that somebody's paying attention to this and, you know, watching out for everyone.
So happy solar cycle 25, everybody.
That's all the time we have for this episode of the Hackaday Podcast. As always, we'd love to hear from you. You can leave a comment, the 1,000,001 comment, on the show notes, which you will find at hackaday.com/podcast. You can email us, editor@hackaday.com. We live and die by the tips that you leave in our tips line. So if you see something cool or you've done something cool, tell us about it. tips@hackaday.com. And until next time,
keep on hacking. Do you want to hear what it sounds like to blow into a 3D printed ocarina?
Yes. That's pretty good, Zamfir. I recommend more diaphragmatic breathing. Someday we got to sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat. Can you keep riffing?
Sneeze.
Gazoom tight.
Danke.